One of the most intriguing areas of mathematics, at least in my view, is the mathematics of computation. On the one hand, it's filled with jaw-droppingly beautiful results, one of which, for example, is the Gödel theorem, which states, in essence, that if given any reasonable formal description of mathematics, then there exists an assertion within that system that is not a theorem within that system, but such that the negation of that assertion is also not a theorem, i.e., every reasonable formulation of mathematics has undecidable propositions within it. On the other hand, the mathematics of computability, there are seemingly simple ideas which remain open. And let me just give you an example, and I better warn you that this is what I'm told, but not what I personally know. For example, I'm told that, let's consider the taking problems and doing computations of them, let us say, with Fortran. Let's now introduce a second language, which is Fortran with one additional command. And the additional command is flip a coin, and if it's heads, do this, and if it's tails, do that. I.e., let's take Fortran with coin flips. You can now ask the question, is there any problem for which Fortran with coin flips is more efficient than Fortran itself? That is to say, does having the ability to do random operations ever improve the efficiency of a computation? It's my understanding that that question is open. That is to say that we have no example of a problem for which you can actually get any gain by flipping coins, and we have no proof that there can be no gain from flipping coins. So there's an example of a seemingly simple thing in the area of computation that remains open. Furthermore, not only is computation very beautiful within it, in its mathematical framework, there seem to be potentially interesting connections between the mathematics of computation and physics. So what I thought I would do is give you three examples today of interactions between computation, the mathematics on the one hand, and physics on the other. And all three of these have the same general texture, namely that they look very intriguing, but for some reason things seem to fail right near the end. So the sort of theme of this talk is so close yet so far. It looks like you can really do things, but when you try to pin things down, it appears that it's somewhere between difficult and impossible to make physics impact the mathematics in the way we might wish. So the first of these has to do with what are called Malamud-Hogarth spacetimes. So this is in general relativity. A Malamud-Hogarth spacetime is a spacetime that contains a time-like curve, such that that time-like curve has infinite length, but such that the entire curve lies to the past of some point P. So in Minkowski space, to take an example, there is no such curve in point. If you take any point in Minkowski space and look at its past, then every time-like curve drawn within the past of that point has the property that if it remains forever within the past, then it only has a finite proper length into the future. On the other hand, you can invent examples of spacetimes that have a curve such that the curve is actually of infinite length, but it remains always within the past of a point. Okay, so that's this notion of these spacetimes. And now the intriguing thing about these spacetimes is that that one can, at least in principle, given a Malamud-Hogarth spacetime, compute, for example, the halting problem. The halting problem is the question of whether a given program will ever halt when it's run. So you take whatever your favorite language is, let's say Fortran, ask yourself the question, given a Fortran program, that program either halts or it doesn't halt. And for simple Fortran programs, it's easy to determine whether the program halts or not. The halting problem asks the question, can you write down a program, a Fortran program, that will itself examine Fortran programs and decide whether the given Fortran program, when run, will ever halt? That's the question. And it is a theorem that there exists no program that does that. The halting problem, it is known, is not computable. You might think, why is it so difficult? If you look at a program, I mean, if it does something stupid, like goes to the halt command right away, then it obviously halts. If it does a few little things before going to the halt, then you would think, you could tell, why couldn't you sort of parlay that knowledge into a general algorithm for deciding whether a Fortran program halts, and thus parlay it into a program that decides whether Fortran programs halt. But just to give you an example, let's take some conjecture in number theory, like Goldbach's conjecture, that says there exists integers such that blah, blah, blah. Okay. Then you could write down a program that tries various integers and sees whether blah, blah, blah is true. And if it ever finds a blah, 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 it halts. And if it never finds a blah, 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 it continues forever. The question of whether that program halts will settle the Goldbach conjecture or some other conjecture in number theory. So if you could write a program that would examine programs and decide whether or not they would halt, you would have to, for example, solve essentially all open questions in number theory, because they can all be formulated as the statement that various programs halt. So on its face, it looks to be difficult to do that, and it is a theorem that there's no program that will do that, not surprisingly. However, if we have one of these Malamud-Hogarth spacetimes, we could compute the halting problem. We could decide whether programs halt. And we could do so in the following way. You take the time-like curve gamma of infinite length, and you put a little computer on that time-like curve, and that computer runs the program that you want to know whether halt or not, say the program that looks for counterexamples to some conjecture in number theory. And the computer is programmed to try one case after another, and the instructions of the computer is, if you ever find a counterexample, then you're supposed to flash a red light or yell voila or do something that will send a signal to us now. So then all we do is we sit around and we wait to see if we get the signal. In fact, we don't have to sit around because it's a single event. We simply sit at this event and see if we get the signal or not. If we get the voila signal, then we know that the program halts. And if we don't get the voila signal, we know the program doesn't halt. So in that way, we've computed the halting problem. Yes.
Finite time-like curves from the point where you hit goal on the computer to us now?
The answer, well, I'm trying to decide what level then. Okay, so the naive answer is, I claim given any two time-like related points in any space-time, they can be connected by a time-like curve of arbitrarily short length. For example, so you don't have to worry about but I know that's not what you mean. But the better answer is the discovery of the halting will occur at a specific event along this world line. So this is a perfectly nice event in a perfectly nice space time. So there will always be, for example, a time-like curve of some finite length from the halt event to the point event. We're not asking this point to receive readings for all time along this curve. We're only asking it to receive a single reading, which is I got the counterexample reading. So there'll be some specific point at which that occurs and a specific time-like curve, which therefore will have some finite length. It's even more true if you said, well, I don't like to see signals that have been floating around for more than a week. If you put that as your condition, then I claim there exists a time-like curve of length less than a week that joins the two also. So, yes?
Well, you may be coming to this issue, but I wanted to bring it up. And that is that this computer, you would have to have an infinite memory principle to do this, because like for Goldbach's conjecture, you really have to try every prime number, so you have to use that enough memory. So it's going to be a bit problematic. So.
And I think I would go one step further. I would say everything that interacts, well, computation with physics is problematic in at least that sense. And I think I'd be willing to go and say every step that interacts mathematics with physics, everything in physics is problematic. Right? We talk about a point particle, but there aren't really, how do you ever decide that? And when you get things very small, then other bad things happen. So everything in physics is a kind of idealization. So I'm making here the idealization that somehow we can avoid. It's the idealization of large memories that can be put into small region idealization. So I grant that. But at least it could be argued. that within such spacetimes, which exist, it could be argued that they would provide at least the potential for some physical mechanism for deciding the halting problem. And there do indeed exist such spacetimes. So it's not as though relativity comes packaged with any constraint that disallows trying to do that. But you might say, okay, I grant that you can write down such spacetimes. But you might say, but maybe they're eliminated by Einstein's equation. Do there exist spacetimes that satisfy Einstein's equation that has this property? And the answer is, yeah. I mean, the charged black hole solution, for example, has time-like curves of infinite length divided the path of a single point. So Einstein's equation, for example, does not disallow at least the potential for carrying out this physical solution of the halting problem. However, there is a problem, and the problem is the following. It's all very nice if you happen to be walking down the street and you find a region of space-time which has an infinite length time-like curve such that you can see the entire history of the curve. However, suppose that you walk down the street and you don't find such a space-time. You'd like to build it. And indeed, if you want to compute the halting problem, you have to be able to build it, because we don't want to know the halting problem for one particular program. We want to know the halting problem for every program. That's the thing that's not computable. So there arises the question of whether you can actually make these Malamuth-Hogarth spacetimes. So what we need is a suitable notion of make in general relativity. Well, we have such a notion, namely the notion of a Cauchy surface. In general relativity, recall, a Cauchy surface is a space-like surface S having the property that every time-like or null curve, every signal, meets the surface S, i.e. S is a surface that records the information of all signals. And the spacetimes that one can build in general relativity are precisely the spacetimes that have such Cauchy surfaces. And that's not surprising, because what does build mean besides choose initial data and then evolve the initial data, say, using Einstein's equation? Well, any spacetime that you generate by choosing initial data and then evolving will have the property that that surface from which the evolution took place, that surface will be a Cauchy surface. So having a Cauchy surface is a formal way of saying things that you can make, things that you didn't just find on the street, but you actually build by getting a big government grant and going into the lab and putting things in different positions. So the question of whether we can build Malamuth-Hogarth spacetime, the question of whether we can really solve the halting problem in the lab is the question of whether we can find spacetimes that have a Cauchy surface, i.e. that are buildable, which, however, are also Malamuth-Hogarth, which also have the property that there's a time-like curve of infinite length lying to the past of a point. Well, having decided all that, I think you all know where this is going. There's a theorem which says, in any spacetime with a Cauchy surface, then it can have no infinite length time-like curve that lies entirely to the past of a point. In other words, there's a theorem in general relativity that says, even though in principle, within the rules of general relativity, there exist these spacetimes which apparently will allow a physical solution of the halting problem, they're disallowed if you require that you actually make the thing in the lab. And so here is a potential place where physics might have impacted our understanding of the computation process, and maybe it does, but in which there's a kind of a loophole that renders it less attractive than it might otherwise have. So this is the first of the three examples. Yeah, Lee.
No,
it's very easy.
So you couldn't help if I change the equation?
No. This is just a statement. No. The statement is as it's stated. So if space-time has a Cauchy surface, then there's no infinite length. Maybe I mean the proof is. The proof is almost easier than the statement. Suppose you have a Cauchy surface and you have a point P, and you wanted to have an infinite length time-like curve that lied to the past of P. Then this time-like curve cannot have a future endpoint because it's infinite length. Okay. So you take this, but these all have to lie to the past of P. So you take a succession of points and draw time-like curves from the point up to P. And then you take the limiting timeline curve. You do it in such a way that you can take the limit of the curves that are drawn from the successive points of gamma up to p. And you take the appropriately done, you take the limiting curve, which is, let's say, it's, I didn't bring my red marker, so let's say it's that. That limiting curve will never be able to reach s, because roughly speaking, it wants to go through the future endpoint of gamma, but gamma has no future endpoint. So that violates the condition that s be a Cauchy surface. That's the proof. So the proof is actually easier than the statement. It's like all these global things in relativity. OK, so this is the first of these. Yes.
Sure. You mentioned the charged black hole as an example of one of those space times. Mm-hmm. And those diagrams tattooed in my brain, but
right.
I can't quite see what.
So here's the charged black hole. So the charged black hole is. OK, so here is. Here's us out here. This is the wormhole here. These are the horizons of the wormhole. This is infinity for us. This is way out there. Okay. This is singular in this area and singular in this area. This is a trip that you would do going into the wormhole. And then if you're careless and go up like that, that's the end of you. If you're a little more careful, you can come out into another universe. You can come out here and have an entire second life if you want. Okay, so here's here's the space time. Okay, so here is the time-like curve of infinite length. This is the time-like curve of somebody who's just living their lives, but staying away, careful person who stays away from the wormhole. Here's the point P, that's the careless person who got inside, right? The past of P is this. And the entire world line is in the past of P. So, but the point here is that this spacetime doesn't have a Cauchy surface, because if you imagine getting the surface by evolving some initial S, the evolution of S, I don't have enough colors to render this properly, but evolution of S is that. So it doesn't include the P. So if you it's all very nice to say, if I find a charged black hole laying around, right, and I'm willing to sacrifice myself. then I will have the personal luxury of knowing whether this particular. Actually, it's kind of interesting, isn't it? Because in this space time, you could actually do the whole problem because it continues. Right? So what you do is you when you're out here, you arrange somebody to try the first machine to see whether it halts or not, and then you go up here and get the answer, and then you take a swing and you go into the next one. You arrange somebody to do the next machine here, and you get the answer. So you just keep going, and each day. You get a new answer, so you actually compute the full Hawking problem. So this is a particular. So if you ever found this laying on the street, it would be great. You could compute the whole. But the problem is you can't build it. So if nature is somehow sufficiently malicious that we aren't handed these on a platter, then we won't be able to do this. So I'm not trying to say whether you can do this or not. I'm just telling you what. The rules about what you can do are is given to us by general relativity. So it's something that looks like it's going to work, but in the end, there's a serious problem. That's the only message that I'm making. Yes, Raphael.
One other potentially serious problem is the instability. Sorry.
That's right, which is really another reflection.
Which is obviously related to the conscious.
Right, so as Raphael's pointing out that if you wave your hands like this out here, you send up radiation that goes up near infinity and then goes running out near the surface. And in general, that radiation will make this surface go bad. It'll make it become singular, so you never would be able to get through. And you might say, well, suppose I'm really careful about that. But then the trouble is that Raphael's going to be careless because he's not really interested in my project. And so he'll wave his hand. So that's the second problem. So when I say find on the street, I mean it has to be on the street and cleverly arranged so that everybody's doing this will all cancel out and not make bad things happen, which is asking for a lot. This is another sort of aspect of the idea that spacetimes would have Cauchy surfaces, because that spacetimes have Cauchy surfaces this isn't a precise result, but the idea is that if they have Cauchy surfaces, then people cannot, by merely moving things around a little bit, destroy interesting regions in those spacetimes. I mean, There's probably even a theorem that says that, that says, you tell me where you want to live in a space-time that has a kosher surface, and I can tell you how, the extent to which people have to tiptoe in order that by doing that, they will not destroy the region where you wanted to live. That's probably true. Okay. So that's example one. So example two begins with the following definition. A real number x is said to be computable. If there exists, when I say Fortran, you just insert whatever language you happen to like. If there exists a computer program such that you give me any rational number epsilon, and the program will ultimately print out another rational number r that's within epsilon of x. In other words, a number is computable if you can write a program that will give rational approximations to the number. You tell me how close you want to be to the number, and the program will produce a rational number that's that close. So for example, 1/3 is computable, and the square root of 2 is computable, and pi is computable. Everybody can write a program that you give me an epsilon, and I'll produce a rational number within epsilon of pi. And this number is computable too. Everything you can think of is computable. So this is the notion of computable numbers. So let me give you an example of a number that's not computable. Okay. So here's a non-computable number. It's the following number. It's the summation of an over 3 to the n, where an is 0 if the nth program halts, and 2 if the nth program does not halt. Okay. So you take all possible computer, say Fortran programs, you get a first, second, third, fourth. Every one of them either halts or doesn't halt. Let an be 0 or 2 according as the program halts or does not halt. So there really is for each n a number an, since every program really does either halt or not halt. So then I take that ans and I just write out the number which to base 3 has the nth digit determined by the result of running the nth program. And that's a perfectly good number, right? Theorem, there exists one and only one number fitting this description. So that's an actual bona fide real number. On the other hand, so just for example, the seventh program here might be the one that searches for a counterexample to the Goldbach conjecture. It's just some Goldbach conjecture means any conjecture you can think of in number theory. I would say Fermat's last theorem, but I'm told that's settled now. So that if I said that, everybody would say, but we know that one. So I think Goldbach isn't, but it doesn't make any difference. So A7, for example, might be 0 if the Goldbach conjecture is false, and 2 if the Goldbach conjecture is true, because the seventh program might be the program that looks for a counterexample. And A10 might be 0 or 2, depending on whether the Poincaré conjecture is true or false. And similarly, some other A's will depend on other conjectures in mathematics. So this number, I claim, is not computable. And the proof is easy, because if you had a program that computes it, a program that, given any epsilon, would find a rational number within epsilon of C, then you could write a program that would compute the halting problem, that would settle whether every program halts or not by simply finding a sufficiently close rational approximation to the number C. So a computation of C is settling the halting problem, and that is, among other things, solving all the conjectures in mathematics. So it's not really likely we'll get such a program. So the message here is that there exist numbers, real, live, actual numbers in the real number system that are, on the other hand, computationally inaccessible in the sense that you cannot find rational approximations to them by any calculation. Okay, that's all very nice. The question is, what does this have to do with physics? Yes.
One of these is the continuum hypothesis, and it turns out to be formally undecidable.
So the question is, what is the program? See, the programs are not discussions. Programs are programs. So if you're worried about the continuum hypothesis, you can certainly write a program that searches for counterexamples. And if it ever finds a counterexample, it'll halt. And if it doesn't, it'll keep looking. That'll be one of the ones in this sequence. And we happen to know that that one will never halt, because there is no counterexample to the continuum hypothesis using regular mathematics.
I'm asking something else.
Yeah.
If some of these conjectures turn out on the axioms of arithmetic of Zermelo-Frankel to be undecidable.
Mm-hmm.
I'm querying your assertion that there is a definite number that's associated with, that depends on an outcome of some of these formally undecidable.
Let's see. It may be that I'm not understanding the question. Let me try to say. So the statement is, you can consider all Fortran programs. You can write down a first, second, third, fourth, fifth program. You can let AN be this thing, because every program either halts or it doesn't halt. You can consider this number C, and the number C is not computable. Those are my own. Okay. Having said all that, okay, everything else is just talky talk, getting you into the mood. Okay, so, Goldbach, Poincaré, that's just trying to get you sort of, give you the idea that it's not so strange that this number's not computable. But the mathematics ends here, right? So I asked you, nobody stopped me from defining AN in this way, from numbering the programs and defining AN this way, defining C in that way, and asserting that C is a real number. That's all I need, and that C is not computable. When I say you can solve the questions in mathematics, that's a sort of getting you in the mood of the questions statement. I don't intend that as a precise statement.
What I'm querying is the statement that every program either halts or doesn't
mm-hmm.
equivalent to the statement that every conjecture in arithmetic is decidable?
No. Because a program is a finite list of Fortran commands. Okay, I don't care what you say about the program, whether you say, I always wanted to know, or whether you say, this is the continuum, this or that. Say whatever you want. A program is just a list of commands. You run the thing, it either halts or it doesn't halt.
Well,
so the mathematics does not care how you interpret the programs. So it doesn't care whether you think the program is looking for a counterexample to Goldbach or something. What I'm claiming is you produce on a piece of paper, or possibly on several pieces of paper, a list of legitimate Fortran commands. You put it into your computer. It will either be the case that that program, when it's run, at some point halts, or that program, when it's run, never halts.
That's what I'm putting, but go ahead.
Okay.
It's not possible to write a program that halts or doesn't halt, depending on whether the continuum hypothesis is true or false. So it's kind of outside his framework.
Right. Although the program that looks for a proof of it within formal mathematics will never halt, and a program that looks for a counterexample within formal mathematics will never halt. So there are programs that have the connotations of the ideas he's interested in. There's just no, as you say, there's no program that does exactly what he wants.
Yeah. Isn't this this sort of the confusion between provability and truth? I mean, Lee's worried about the decidability as to the provability. And these are truth values. The continuum hypothesis might be true or false. That's the assumption, even though it's undecidable. And I think, and therefore the number, assuming that all these, the Goldbach conjecture, Poincaré conjecture, and so on, are either true or false, this is a well-defined number. And the decidability of these questions within a given axiomatic framework is a separate
set of issues. So I think the best way to read this, if you have this concern, is just to read it up to this point. All you have to do is accept that, given the final this is the way to read it. Now, I mean, this is what I'm trying to say. This is not interesting.
There's a computer in there making it do that.
I thought it was just for me. Okay. So the best way to read it, I think, is to read it to here. All you have to, by a Fortran program, is a finite list of commands. So even if we never heard of mathematics, I think everybody would agree that such a list either halts or doesn't halt. In fact, I don't exactly agree with that either, but that's another set of issues. Okay. So, in any case, we have these numbers around, and now we have to ask what they have to do with physics. So, you might think, well, what they have to do with physics is whether any number in the real world is a non-computable number. So, you might ask yourself the question, is the fine structure constant, for example, non-computable? And my claim is, the position I'd like to take, is that that's a nonsensical question. the question of whether the actual fine structure constant in the actual world is computable or not. Because what possible things could you do to ever decide that? After all, the computable numbers, the ones that are dense in the reals. So given any actual real number, within every epsilon of it, there's computable numbers. In fact, there's rational numbers. So what experiment could you possibly imagine to decide the question, is the fine structure constant computable? I can't think of one, because you can do experiments that measure the fine structure constant as accurately as you wish, let us say, and that will give you no evidence whatever as to whether the fine structure constant is computable or not. So the question, is a real number in the real world computable? At least I'm taking the position that that question is meaningless. There is, however, a meaningful question, at least meaningful to me, and that is the question of whether a theory predicts that a number is computable. So what I'm claiming is computable, a real number actually in the real world is computable, is nonsense, but predicts, a theory predicting computable, that's meaningful. And and it's meaningful because theories generally are pieces of mathematics, and you go through the mathematics and it makes predictions of things. And you just ask whether the prediction that comes out of the mathematics happens to be one of these non-computable guys. So I want to make the distinction between what really is and what the theory says. Please.
Measure the fine structure constant to any precision.
Yeah.
Isn't that in fact an algorithm for doing so? And doesn't that imply that it is computable according to your definition?
But that's a good point. Everyone hear that? That's a good point, except that the definition is about mathematics and the observations are about the physical world. Just because we define a non-computable number as there exists no program, blah, blah, blah. A program is a formal thing defined within mathematics, say a Turing machine or something. The fact that, say, there's no Turing machine that does that doesn't mean that the physical world was constructed in such a way that the fine structure constant really is non-computable. Little arguments we make about Turing machines don't tell the physical world how to behave. The physical world, as we all know, doesn't really care too much what we think, right? It just goes on its own route. So it's certainly possible I don't want to take a position on whether it's possible that the real fine structure is computable. What I would like to say is the issue of whether it's computable or not, to my mind, does not have meaning. On the other hand, I am going to claim that the issue about whether a physical theory predicts that a number is computable does have meaning. You can have some super-duper electrodynamic something or other that predicts a value for the fine structure constant, for instance, and you could go through the mathematics of the theory, and it might predict a number that is ultimately not computable. Yeah?
You're getting to this, but is the assumption then that the theory doesn't call any dimensional parameters? It's perfectly dimensionless. I mean, see, both ordinary physical theories have things like the fine structure constant in them,
but why,
which are experimental inputs.
Well, I could imagine some theory that would predict fine structure. After all, I mean, we live in the world, theories predict the world. Why couldn't a theory predict the value of the fine structure constant?
Well, you don't even need a theory. All you need is a formula that happens to agree with the fine structure constant, and people try to produce such things in optimistic moments.
We're not that optimistic. Right?
Yeah, but suppose it agrees with all measurements. You still don't know if it's correct.
That's right.
But what
I would like to claim, just as an aside, which I think is along the lines of these remarks, is that had it happened, if there were a theory that predicted for a physical observation, say something, I'm using fine structure constant because it's dimensionless, it gets us out of it, that predicted that it would be a very different kind of physics than we're used to, for the following reason. We're used to the physics in which the theoreticians say, we predict that this number will be 2.914242764, and the experimentalist says, well, I've only got know that it's 2.1 plus or minus 0.3, and then they go off for another 20 years and they say it's 2.31. They have some other error bracket. And meanwhile, the theoreticians can get another 96 significant digits. We live in a world in which the theoreticians can easily say what the number ought to be in the theory, and the whole burden is on the experimentalist. If there was a theory that predicted a non-computable number, then at least in principle, the roles could be reversed. We could have a situation where the theory has a perfectly definite prediction. But the trouble is that there's no program that will produce the so that if you want to get the number to within 0.1, you've got to settle the Goldbach conjecture. And you want to get it to within 0.01, you have to settle some other question in number theory. In other words, we can have a situation in which the experimentalists say, oh, we've measured it to 2 points, and the theoreticians are saying, well, I know that it's 2.1 plus or minus 0.1, but I haven't been able to solve the next conjecture that I need to compute the number. So it would be an interesting, a potentially interesting kind of physics if there ever were a number that was not computable. So you might think, oh, this is all very nice talky talk. What is the real story? Well, there actually is an example in which there's some indication that there might actually be a non-computable number that's a prediction. This is due to Harville. And it's the following idea, that suppose you imagine in doing some kind of quantum gravity through some kind of Feynman path integral formulation. So you take the initial geometry, the final geometry, you take the intermediate four geometries, which are like the dynamical paths, you work out the action of each one, you take e to the I action by h bar, you sum over all the histories, and that's the transition amplitude. So imagine that you had that. Well, there's a little, so you can represent the four manifolds for purposes of doing the computation as sequential complexes. And now, arguably at least, in the Feynman sum, however, you don't want to have repetitions. You don't want to include the same four manifold several times. So in the computation of this transition amplitude, you have to eliminate the cases where you have one four manifold that's described as a simplicial complex in two different ways. So you need a little subroutine in the program that will take two simplicial complexes that describe four manifolds and decide if they're the same four manifold in order to leave that term, extra term, out of the Feynman sum. Well, it is known, so I'm told, that that's a non computable problem. It is apparently known that there's no Fortran program that will examine two simplicial complexes for four manifolds and decide if they represent the same four manifold. Therefore, at least if you're going to do things this way, you potentially have a step in the calculation that is known to be performable by no computer, even though this, say, will be a perfectly definite transition amplitude. And therefore, it's entirely possible that the final transition amplitude will itself be a non-computable number, because the obvious way of computing it seems to require that we carry out a computation, namely comparison of these complexes, that is known not to be doable by any program. And therefore, it's possible that quantum gravity might actually have an actual real physical prediction that would be a non-computable number. I want to emphasize, however, that a non-computable number is not a number such that the obvious way you thought of to compute it gives you problems. Computability is a property of the number. It's entirely possible that even though you have this little problem in applying the theory, that all the transition amplitudes, for example, are computable, or all the measurable amplitudes might be computable. So there's no guarantee that this actually will produce, as a physical prediction of the theory, a number that's not computable. On the other hand, this at least illustrates the little issue that it is that there's no, I know of no grand argument that says non-computable numbers can never arise in physical theories, because here's an example where you can at least imagine such a number arising. Yes?
Forel and Richards have a paper in which they show that the wave equation can have uncomputable solutions even with computable inputs.
I've heard of that, I mean, my heart doesn't believe it, but
we don't really care what my heart believes. So.
I'm not a physicist, yeah, so. Okay. But the paper's there.
Okay, so that's the second one. So the second one is this sort of tantalizing hint that mathematics might be able to compute things that we can't compute otherwise.
Do you remember where the obstacle is in trying to decide what simplicial complex is?
I don't actually know the theorem. I'm told of that.
It's pi 1, I think.
It's what?
It's in trying to figure, you have to figure out what the first homotopy group is.
Yes, it's classifying homotopy groups up to change their bases.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to know that the two are isomorphic or, you know, homeomorphic, then they would have to, in particular, have the same Pi 1, the same first homotopy.
And sorry, can you do the homotopy?
And, no, you can't. You have to be able to do it from generators and relations is to solve the word problem for groups.
I see. Okay.
That's known to be
solvable.
Okay. So if you, like, if you limited them to simply connected, I think you would eliminate them. But of course, there's no reason the theory should limit them.
Yeah, so I'm absolutely not trying to argue that these numbers come up. I'm only trying to argue that there's a little window that through which you can. I'm trying to. The minimalist argument is that it's not absurd that physical theory might have such a prediction. I think that is all I'd really like to get agreement on. Not that it's going to happen or that it's imminent or. After all, I mean, this quantum gravity, this sort of thing, is just talky talk anyway, so it's not as little a theory. But the point is that it's not ridiculous that the mathematics that we do in constructing theories may involve steps that cannot be carried out by computers, and therefore that the predictions could have that property. So it's not absurd that someday the experimentalists will be able to say, ha, 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 here's the first 10 digits, and we'll still be working on the second digit. Yes.
But computable, you're implicitly referring to on a classical computer. So
right.
Wouldn't this new theory of physics allow a new type of computer, which then could compute?
Arguably, yeah, arguably. On the other hand, it would only be true. That would only be the case if the theory is true, right? Because I claim there's no meaning to saying that the real number in the real world is computable. It's only a statement about the theory. So, yes, if the theory is correct. But now you have to worry about, do I believe the theory, and how much do I believe the theory, and so on. So.
We believe classical theory?
Well, I don't know what I believe, but what I'm saying is that it's not as simple as simply building the apparatus and being done with it, because you have to believe that the theory exactly describes the world, because otherwise you're not computing it. So that's a big step to take. But if you have that conviction, then you might say, well, I don't have to have that conviction. Maybe the real number in the real world is not computable. That, I'm saying, doesn't have meaning. That's only what I'm saying. Maybe it does have meaning. That's just the position I'm taking.
Mr. Feynman argues that there is no such thing as the true theory. You can only disprove theories. You cannot prove them at all.
Right. So certainly we wouldn't want to prove it, but on the other hand, we might say, I'm really confident about this, and therefore, that confidence, I have equal confidence that we could, using physical mechanisms, compute the Hulking problem or whatever it is that's encoded in the numbers. So you can have some relative level of confidence. Maybe that's the best you can do. I don't have, except for these sort of raw ideas, I don't have much to say. I mean, there is such a thing within mathematics as these numbers, and I want to argue that it's at least reasonable they might come up in physical theories. And here's an example, but alas, there's all these issues that it's not quite clear exactly. It's like the first. I want it to be kind of like the first example. The first example says we could compute the Hulking problem in these spacetimes, but physics says, wait a minute, there are these problems. Here it says we could compute non-computable numbers using physical theories, but there are all these issues that are kind of sneaking in and giving us trouble. So it's both supposed to be so near yet so far, we don't quite get where we want to go. Yes?
So if we don't demand that the theory has to be true, which I think is probably a good idea.
Good, okay. I'm with that.
Then suppose I have a new theory. The fine structure constant is exactly Chaikin's number. There's my theory.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly an uncomputable, it predicts that the fine structure constant is an uncomputable number. So. I want you to tell me why that's not satisfying, other than the obvious reason.
The problem there is that not satisfying it's not satisfying, okay?
Yes.
But, you know, I mean, it's very hard for me to tell you in less than 100 sentences why it's not, I don't like that kind of theory. So, but I'm not trying to say that other people can't have those kinds of theories and other people can't have attitudes on. But I'm trying to say a little more than the statement, hey, you can just say, make the theory be that C is the answer. you could get the kind of theory that we typically get, where we apply ideas that we know and we have little calculations, the sort of thing we do, that even that could in principle lead to non-computable numbers. But I grant that that's a kind of a gray area. So I don't want to take but I'm trying to say more than the statement that you could invent. You could say, that's C, I deem it to be the fine structure concept. I want to say it's a little better than that. But how you judge that is everyone can take their own personal judgment on that issue. I don't have anything to say that's useful on that. Okay, yes, one more question. I want to do the last example.
Yeah. Suppose there is some theory which gives you some prediction about some observer which is not, the theory tells you it's not a computer.
Okay.
But that wouldn't that mean that the theory is not testable experimentally? So why would I?
Sure, it's testable.
I mean, if.
Well, how accurately you want to do it? You want to do it in one part in 100? Okay, then settle the Goldbach conjecture and settle these other things, which I presume will happen by 2,346, right? And then you can do the job. Nobody seems to mind an experimentalist take 30 years, right? It's somehow a crisis. Okay, let me give my last example. This is just a remark. By the way, there not only are there numbers that are non-computable, but there are numbers that are arbitrarily hard to compute. There's a theorem that says, you tell me how hard you want to compute it to be to compute the number, and there exists a number that's that hard to compute. So you give me any recursive function f of n, and then there exists a number such that a Fortran program that will compute that number within 1 over n requires at least f of n steps. So if you choose f of n to be 2 to the 2 to the 2 n times, for example, then f of 5 is already 10 to the 18,000th, which is presumably more resources than there are in the whole universe. So there is also, just by the way, you can also parlay this, even if you don't do non-computable numbers, into very hard to compute numbers. And there's a theorem that says there's arbitrarily hard to compute numbers in this world. So this just an aside. Okay. So the third one has to do with using quantum mechanics in computation. So let me tell you about a problem, the needle in the haystack problem. So the needle in the haystack problem, you're given an integer n, a positive integer, and you're considering k's that have to be from 1 to n. So think of the n as the haystack and the k as the needle. And we imagine that we have a program p which accepts as input n and k. So it accepts as input the haystack and a candidate for the needle. And this program P, we're now demanding, be such that given any N and any K in this range, will output either the word yes or the word no. So think of this as the program to check whether a needle candidate in a given haystack is indeed the needle. And it's supposed to have the property that for given N, this program says yes for one and only one K. Okay, so we imagine we have a problem where you have haystacks, you have candidates for needles, and the program will check whether a given needle is the needle in that haystack. And let's suppose that this program runs in a number of steps that depends on the haystack. So h of n might be some rapidly growing function of n. It's how many steps the program takes to check whether a given candidate for the needle is actually the needle or not. Okay. And now, so suppose the problem is to find the needle. So I'm going to give you n, and you have to find which k, which is the k naught, for which this program says yes. Okay, that's the problem. And there's an obvious way to compute the problem. Namely, if you give me n, and I want to find which is the k, what I do is I run this program p for that n, and for each of the successive values of k, from 1 to up to n, I keep going until I find the k for which this program says yes, and that will happen because there's one and only one, and then I report the needle. So here's given a program that tests for needles, here's how to build a program that finds the needle by just going through the needle candidates. And this program will require n times h of n steps in general, the naive checking program, because it'll have to run h of n about n times, or maybe n by 2 or something. We don't care about a factor of 2. So here is a sort of candidate kind of problem The problem is one for which you have a program that checks needle candidates, but the real problem is finding the needle. And we can find a computer that, given a computer that does needle checks, we can make a computer that finds the needle that has this many steps. Okay, so consider a problem of that kind. So the problem might be find the largest prime less than n, or something like that. And so the checking program will simply checks whether a given k is the largest prime less than n. Okay. And if you want to find, given n, what k is, then you simply run this check program for all the values of k. Okay. Now, it is alleged that quantum mechanics, and it depends on how the program runs, but this is more or less true, that quantum mechanics can actually, in this scenario, can actually find the needle more easily than n times h of n. It can do it in n square root of n times h of n steps. So if n is large, the difference between a factor of n and the factor of the square root of n can be very large. So it is alleged that you can write down unitary operators and build quantum systems and so on. Use quantum mechanics in the computation to find the needle in this many steps. So this looks like an example then in which physics is impacting the computational process, not in the these other Hogarth, Malamant, or Hartle ways, but in a kind of more direct way. It's allowing you to do computations more efficiently. So consider now the following mathematical assertion. So the assertion is, let pi be a map from the set of positive integers, which is the n, to the set of integers from 1 to n. So it's a map that takes any positive integer and returns an integer from 1 up to n. Consider any such map. And let p be a program, a Fortran program, or whatever your favorite language is, that will test a given nk in this many steps and tell you either yes or no. Tell whether it is the integer that's the image under the map pi. Okay. Then the statement is there exists a program, a regular Fortran program, that will find the needle by some shortcut. It'll find the needle in a way that's faster. I'm afraid to do the square root of n because the computer will panic. You can find a program that will find the needle faster than the naive way. You can find a shortcut to find the needle that will do so in only this many steps. So this is just an assertion in mathematics. It's not an assertion about quantum mechanics. It's not an assertion about the world. It's an assertion about mathematics. Okay. So the mathematical assertion is, let there be given a program that accepts as input a positive integer and a k in this range. Let the program return either yes or no, with yes for only one and only one k. Let the program take that many steps. Then there exists a second program that will find the needle, find the k naught for each given n in a number of steps that's substantially less than the number of steps that would be required to test all the needles one at a time using the program p. Okay, that's an assertion. If this assertion were false, that is to say, if you could find an example of a pi and a program such that you could prove that there's no shortcut program, then you'd be well on your way to showing that quantum mechanics can actually result in an efficiency in the computation process, since more or less quantum mechanics could do this problem in this number of steps, and you would have established that there's no regular Fortran program that will do the problem in this many steps. If, on the other hand, this assertion were true, that would mean that quantum mechanics is never going to help you in this kind of a problem, because it would say, whatever quantum mechanics can do, we can always do. So now the strange thing, to me strange, is that this is an open question. And it seems like such a simple open question. So the question is, can you think of an example, some rule, that take given an integer n, determines one particular k between 1 and n, and a program that computes it. So you need to give me the actual Fortran program that will, given n and k, will check to see whether that k is the right one, such that there's no shortcut to finding the k except to try all the values. So it looks like it's a no shortcut in this sense. So it looks like it's a kind of elementary thing, and on its face you think you could probably find an example. For example, the prime one doesn't work, because if P is the program, if the map sends n to the largest prime less than n, and the program P simply checks whether a given k is the largest prime less than n, there's a much faster way to find the largest prime less than n, other than simply checking every number from 1 to n. Namely, you start at n, and you ask whether it's prime, and you work your way back until you hit the first one that's prime. And that'll be the largest prime that's less than n. So in this, for that example of a problem, where the problem is the largest prime less than, there's a shortcut that's much faster than this. Namely, you just start from the top and work your way back. On the other hand, if you had, so the problem is if you have an adjective like the largest in there, that's the tip-off as to how to write the shortcut program that finds the needle. Because as soon as it sees the largest, it starts at the top and works back. And so it's going to go faster than this. So, but on the other hand, if you don't have an adjective, if you don't have any of the largest, but you just say it's some prime that does something or other, then the problem is that if you're careless, there'll be many primes that have that property, and then there won't be a unique needle. So then you have to say, OK, I want to put in further rules to make sure there's only one. So you need some other thing that says, well, it's the one that is the most blah, blah, blah. But as soon as this other program here is the blah, 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 that's the tip off on how to find the shortcut. So what I'm, it seems to me remarkable that this question, which it's like, well, I'm not saying it's the most elementary question one has ever heard, but I mean, certainly something you can think about in the shower, right? It doesn't require calculation. This question, first of all, it seems to be open, and on it hangs, I think, I'm not saying the future of quantum mechanics or anything, but on it hangs this particular strategy for using quantum mechanics to improve the computation process. So in particular, then, a counterexample, I think, would be extremely, extremely valuable in understanding how quantum mechanics interacts with computation. And I don't know, it just doesn't look that hard. It's really instructive to look for examples, because you often think, oh yes, I've sort of got one, and then you always, and the thing is that the shortcut is not, it isn't a tricky shortcut. It's a shortcut that just listens carefully to what the example is. You might say, oh, I know how to do an example. I'll just let the map be random k. So the map will randomly, given an n, will produce a k. But the trouble then is that there's no single program that will do the test, because you need there to be a program that actually does the test. And so you can't let P decide what K is. You have to specify the map right at the beginning. And there must exist a Fortran program that does the check. And then the statement is, once you specify what the map is, and once you give me the actual lines of the Fortran program that does the check, then it's always possible to find a sneaky program that gets the needle without doing the checks. So I'm sort of inviting people to see if somebody can prove, counterexample, or otherwise say something on this, which I think, so this is the third example of a place where physics might impact computation. And again, it sort of hangs on some funny little feature. Please.
One subtlety in this one, which I don't know whether it matters to your point or not, and my question is actually whether it matters. I mean, there's a distinction between saying that given P, I can then produce this program that claims to exist, and given P, this program exists somewhere out there in the mathematical world, but I don't know how to find it.
It's the second that I'm asking for. I'm not asking for a program that accepts as input P's and produces as output shortcuts.
Right, okay.
I'm asking, does there exist a P for which you can prove that there's no shortcut? Mm-hmm. Or can you prove that for every P there exists a shortcut?
Right.
So I'm always asking. I agree that the other one is a harder question maybe, and it's a different question. So in a way this is the easy question, right? All you have to do is think of a rule.
I'll agree with that.
From one end, a rule that selects out some K, but it's very hard and such that it's easy to test, but it's hard to find it other than testing. And if you ever find that, then you're basically home free on this assertion. I don't know. It doesn't look that hard.
This relates to the P versus NP.
It is P versus NP.
Except that it's I'm not trying to make the distinction between polynomial and exponential. This is a sort of mini P versus NP. This is a square root of N. This isn't an exponential difference. This is only a square root of N difference. But the advantage of it is,
well, if you prove you can't even get a square root n difference,
then you're done.
That still implies p
So is, you mean if you could prove that the...
It's at least as hard as P van Dyck.
If you prove this insertion false, then you have P different from NP.
Yeah, okay, that's right. Yeah. Okay, but to me, this is, well, I don't know. From my mindset, it's easy because I find it easy to try to think of examples, right? But this one is fairly direct to the quantum mechanics, and that we're kind of home free on doing this kind of problem with quantum mechanics. Okay, thank you.
Bob will be around
until Friday. I'll be here through Friday.
Through Friday, yeah. Right. My people love dinner tonight.